Last Easter Sunday, during the afternoon, Grace's best friend came over. It wasn't a play date. They were to hang out. I'll get that right. And she said to me, "Belinda, you know about this sort of thing. Is Easter a sad day for Christians?" Now, I assumed that this question came from her limited knowledge of Christian faith. And I said, no, not at all. Sunday is a happy day in the Christian calendar. It's a day when Christians remember that Jesus was raised from the dead. It's Good Friday that's usually more reflective and somber. That's the sad day, if you're thinking about a sad day. But then, thankfully, I had the sense to say, "Why do you ask?" "Well," she said, "great-grandma came over for lunch. And she said that she was always sad now on Easter Sunday, that she'd been to visit grandma's grave this morning, and that Easter made her sad." And as we continued to talk, I thought this is what Jeanette had preached about that morning, that sometimes in our Easter exuberance, in our Easter joy, we forget that people continue to grieve for those they have lost. And we pass over the pain, the confusion, the fear, and the skepticism of that first group of believers as they mourned the one they had lost. For this is how Luke tells the story. The women had waited and wept through the long hours of the Sabbath, and they now go to the tomb expecting to find a body that they can prepare for a proper burial. Instead, what they find is the tomb open and empty. As scholar William Loder says, the emptiness makes space in the story for their distress. They were perplexed about this, the text says. And then they encounter angels, two men in dazzling clothes, who offer them no comfort, as in the other Gospels, no, "Do not be afraid." Instead, they rebuke the women with the question, "Why are you seeking the living among the dead?" And when the women rush to tell the 11 and all the rest, their message is dismissed as an idle tale. Idle tale is a fairly generous translation of the Greek word, leros, the root of our word, delirious. What they thought was that these women had gone mad. And this is where the story of the Christian church begins. Our story begins with this group of Jesus followers who experienced the devastating loss of the one they had followed and who struggled to comprehend what his resurrection might mean. How were they to go on? What did life after death look like? What did discipleship after death and resurrection look like? It was like fire had raised the cathedral roof and left them exposed and vulnerable. It was like the ground had shaken beneath their feet, shaking their foundations and demolishing the landmarks that they had known. My daughter Grace keeps changing the radio station in my car, not to hit 104.7, as you might imagine, but to ABC Classic FM. And so it was a few weeks ago that I heard Russell Torrance and Ed Ayres talking about an article that Ed had posted about how Christchurch would respond to the recent tragedy there, particularly about how the Christchurch Symphony Orchestra had responded to trauma before. After the big earthquake in September 2010 and the really big earthquake in February 2011, the Christchurch Symphony Orchestra lost all of its performance and rehearsal space. They were not alone. 85% of the city of Christchurch was destroyed by the earthquake or had to be rebuilt or had to be demolished following the earthquake. To most orchestras, it would have appeared that there was nowhere to play and there was no point in continuing as an orchestra. But the CSO is not like other orchestras. What they did, according to the CEO of the orchestra, Gretchen LaRoche, in the months and years after the earthquake, was to seek to find the essence of the orchestral art form. Ed writes, in other words, they asked what was completely necessary for the orchestra to continue and what could they do without? The first thing they could do without was a dedicated concert space. Within weeks, the orchestra was giving concerts in a variety of places, including an aircraft hangar, one that was still in use. Three aeroplanes and two helicopters had to be removed every time they did a concert, and Gretchen had to check the weather report because the hangar had a tin roof. Another thing that wasn't necessary was the standard repertoire. In the months after the earthquake, the whole CSO and smaller groups of musicians went to schools, old people's homes, special needs centres, prisons, and responded to what people wanted to hear, what people wanted to play. And they have kept on doing this. But it's rarely traditional classical repertoire. A school student might write a poem, and the musicians help turn it into rhythm and music, often using found objects. Prisoners guide a workshop with the music and the words and the movement that they want to make, not what is prescribed for them. The orchestra now gives half of their time to community work and half to concerts, which is a rare thing in the orchestral world. They didn't just find a way to survive after the earthquake, but they increased their audience fourfold. Gretchen LaRoche comments, "We bring people together. We provide opportunities for people to find their own ways to process what has happened. We love our community. We want to serve it in any way we can." And it seems to me that this is the story of the early church as well. They did not remain devastated, but in the months and the years after Jesus' death and resurrection, they sought to find the essence of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. As Peter's sermon in the house of Cornelius, the Roman centurion, reveals, Peter says, "Now I truly understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him." They had to find new forms. And they found new venues and non-standard repertoire to respond to what people needed to hear, to what people needed to be part of. In Acts chapter 2, it says they shared things in common. They sold possessions and goods and were generous with the proceeds. They spent time together. They spent time in the temple. They broke bread in their homes and they ate with glad and generous hearts. And verse 47 says, and day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. Is this our story as well? Over the last few years, we have reflected on how the place of the church in our society has changed. How the numbers of those who identify as Christian, least on census night, has been gradually declining over the past 50 years in Australia. In 1966, it was 88%. And in the 2016 census, it was 52%. And how the number, the category that has increased noticeably, is those who report having no religion, 30% in 2016. It's like a fire has raised our cathedral roof and left us exposed and vulnerable. It's like the ground has shaken beneath our feet, shaking our foundations, demolishing the landmarks that we have known. As Phyllis Tickle writes in The Great Emergence, we are currently undergoing one of our every 500-year upheavals in culture and worldview that will inevitably reshape our faith interpretations and institutions as surely as the great schism of the 11th century and the great reformation of the 16th century. We need to find new venues, new forms, to discover non-standard repertoire. Not so we can engage in strategic evangelism simply to swell our numbers, but because we too want to bring people together. We too want to provide opportunities for people to find their own ways to process what is happening in their lives, to find where God is happening in their lives. We too want to release people so they can create the music and the words and the movement that they want to make, not what is prescribed for them. We want to enable people to sing hymns that they didn't remember that they knew. Hymns that articulate their pain and their love and their hope and their faith. We too want to find the essence of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. In other words, we too love our community and want to serve it in any way we can.